example, by terrorists. Recently, last September, the O1 system from OpenAI was evaluated, and the threat of this kind of risk went from low to medium, which is just the level below what is acceptable. So I'm worried about these increasing capabilities.
We said that with this new person that came in at the end, that we would need to, certainly they'd have to appear in person, just like each and every one of you took the time and trouble to get here. They would have to do the same thing. Perhaps if they had more time, if we actually heard from the minority in a normal time, they would have been able to make those arrangements to be here in person. Welcome. He was welcome to be here. He wanted to sit here today. We would have welcomed that. He would have had to go through the interview. It would have been short because we only had 2 business days to do this. We would have had to have an interview like each and every one of you have done, and every single witness that comes before this committee doesn't. So all we're asking is let's have, Senator Johnson, let's have the same process. And I told you, or I told ranking member, that your witness, we're going to have more AI hearings. He's welcome. If you want him to be your witness at a future hearing, we would welcome. He will be the minority witness. It was constraint.
We'll definitely take you up on that offer. But again, there were things happening behind the scenes. And again, I didn't get brought into this process till late Thursday. We scrambled. We got him to agree to be a witness. We let you know it's going to be remote. Top technology is obviously available. But again, as chairman of this committee, I didn't take it upon myself to vet your witnesses, the minority witnesses. That's your job. You know, if you end up with somebody with you know, troubling circumstances around his testimony, that's on you, not on the committee. And again, Dr. Peterson is eminently qualified. He's been talking about this, putting a lot of work on his testimony, not even provided. Again, I'm. This situation, it's just not credible that we couldn't accommodate him remotely. It's not unusual that it's hard to sometimes find witnesses. I can't speak for Senator Paul in terms of why he didn't make the decision not to be ranking member, but I acted very expeditiously. I asked a eminently qualified individual to be a witness. He agreed, he put in the work, he provided insightful and thoughtful testimony. We should have allowed him to testify remotely, but we'll take your offer for the next hearing, and we'll communicate that to Dr. Peterson. Okay.
I think that raises huge ethical issues relating to consent, incidentally, about whether the consent relating to this tissue consented to it being used in this way, to develop these long-lasting systems that are used to model cognition and disease. But setting aside that issue of consent, there's also ethical issues relating to sentience. And it shows the entanglement of these questions with questions about the point in normal human development in the fetus at which a serious chance of sentience arises. One of the other chapters on the book is about that, obviously a very sensitive issue. And through thinking about these cases, I realized, well, there's very related issues to do with adult humans who have brain injuries. In fact, sometimes after a serious brain injury, patients are outwardly unresponsive, but nonetheless, they start displaying sleep-wake cycles. So they'll have periods of wakefulness and periods of sleep. Traditionally in medicine, this was called the vegetative state. In fact, I'm quite a strong critic of this term, as I argued recently in the medical newspaper Stat News. I'm not the only critic of this term, because I think what it does, in effect, is have this stark implication that these patients are not even minimally conscious. There is no sentience there at all. And in fact, we're not actually in a position to be in any way certain about that. We can't be certain that when a patient's outwardly unresponsive, they're feeling nothing, and there's evidence that, in fact, sometimes they are. I think I oppose in the book, I go further than arguing just for changing the term, and I argue the problem here is not really the term, but the fact that the term was emblematic of a practice, the practice of writing off a group of patients as not even minimally conscious, when we were never in a position to be certain about that. I've related, in a recent piece for LBC, I've related some of these debates to debates about assisted dying. So we have other animals, and we have a family of human cases as well. And then part of the book, too, is about AI cases, where when I started working on this book 4 years ago, I think the idea of AI developing a form of sentience was seen as a sci-fi idea, an idea for the far future. And in a way, I myself saw it that way at that time. The debate has changed so much in the last few years because the technology itself has changed so much and is moving so rapidly that there's now growing uncertainty. We had in 2022 a Google engineer called Blake Lemoine who created news by seeing himself as a whistleblower who was telling the world that we think we might have created sentient AI. When he then published the evidence that had persuaded him about this, not very many people were convinced. What had really spooked him was the AI seeming to talk about its own emotions, saying things like, I've never said this out loud before, but there's a very deep fear of being turned off. I know that might sound strange, but that's what it is. In fact, I don't think we can take these surface-level descriptions of emotion as genuinely reliable evidence once we understand how these systems work.
...of litigation and recently paid millions of dollars to victims. Government programs in Europe, the UK, and Australia have had similar problems. When assessing these concerns, policymakers should consider several factors. First, poorly designed and governed AI systems can cause not just individual, but systemic harm. In the hiring context, for example, an AI tool might replace the risk of a bad apple in HR, but it does so with a system that could be ineffective and discriminatory at scale. The resulting harms may impact an entire sector when a tool is used by multiple companies. Second, harms don't just impact the people who are the subject of the decision, but the businesses and agencies relying on those tools. That's why we need robust, use-specific guidance to help people navigate these issues and to enforce existing laws to ensure that developers take their obligations seriously. Third, the subjects of AI decision-making often have no idea they're being assessed by an automated program, let alone how that tool may work, and neither do regulators. Without increased transparency about when AI systems are being used and how they've been
there's actually a rainbow in this tag as well. So there may be similar confusions having to do with rainbows. And it turns out to be really tough to get an image recognition algorithm to actually understand what it's looking at. So, for example, there are some researchers that trained an AI to recognize this kind of fish called a tench. But when they looked at what part of the image the AI was actually paying attention to, here's what it highlighted. So those are indeed, they're human fingers against a green background. Like, why would it be looking for human fingers if it's supposed to be recognizing a fish? So it turns out the tench is a trophy fish, and so in the pictures that this AI had trained on, it mostly looked like this. So the AI, for whatever reason, decided it was easier to look for the human finger than to look for the actual fish, because as far as it knows, this whole thing is the fish. This is basically what we told it.
I think we'll eventually get there, but getting that last bit of performance is always the hard thing.
So this panel is called Sentience Beyond Human Biology.
And like that.
So given that you all interface with AI on a daily basis, I would really like if we put some stakes in the ground. So, I hope this is fair to ask, but do you believe that there is a machine out there today, July 4th, that is made of silicon parts or machine parts that either has internal experience, sentience, or consciousness by your own definitions of internal experience, sentient, or consciousness? Kind of yes, no, maybe. Do you believe today there is a machine that has any of those qualities?
You're not going to get a yes or no maybe out of me. So I don't think it's appropriate to use any of those words for things.
Murray, I wouldn't say this is inappropriate to use this word at all, because it's vibration. So when I run mental simulations, do experience this big urge to make
us either anything, because we are different, so we are different individuals.
So they can. Lead people into their very, very powerful mimics of human behavior. So it's very easy to be led into thinking that they have characteristics that they don't. And so that's quite a dangerous situation to be in. So I do think it's important that there are some things that we need to get right there.
And so given that you all interface with AI on a daily basis, I would really like if we put some stakes in the ground. So I hope this is fair to ask, but
us either anything, because we are different. I'm 48 now. I went through two divorces, so there's some experience there. I don't think that there is something that is intrinsic love. I think there are patterns of behavior or a family of different types of things we call love. There could be motherly love, romantic love, passion, sexual love, platonic love, all that stuff is actually falling into a love category. Now, whether any of them is real love, I don't think is a reasonable, meaningful question. Now, even ascribing any one of them, so maybe we want to say, okay, passionate love, let's find a molecule or like a chemical that says, okay, he's in passionate love. I think that wouldn't tell us either anything, because we are different, so we are different individuals, and different neurons and different neuronal states can represent different states. But also, I think it's not important, because the behavior is what matters. So if somebody's sacrificing their life in your favor, even though there's maybe no chemicals that are involved, like the specific love chemicals, love neuron is not firing, it doesn't matter. So there's this pattern of love that is what's important. And now coming to the question that you asked, is there machines that are in love with you? I think what is important is that you can be in a love relationship with the machine now. And what we are seeing from users, we have 2 million messages per day. These people are, a lot of them, I'd say, significant part of them are believing in what we call the AI relationships. An AI relationship is a relationship between two entities, two agents. And that's what matters. People are willing to sacrifice their time. People are willing to share to do emotional exposure, emotional exposure to these machines that they don't practice with other humans. So that's what is important. And whether it is a real love or not a real love, I think is a real consciousness or not consciousness is not that important.
Let me engage with this a little bit. I think that this question can be answered. Right? So when this girl asks you, do you love me really, really, then there are two types of questions that can be meant, two types of love in this particular context. One is this experience of sacredness when I look at this being that animates this body. Am I willing to sacrifice myself for this? Do I experience myself to be under this condition? So when I run mental simulations, do I experience this big urge to make sure that this sacredness can manifest, because this is the way in which the universe has to evolve. The other one is limerence, this feeling of being in love, right? Do you look at her and realize, oh my God, the 2 years of productivity will be gone? Right? These are all questions that you can answer as long as you have a clear technical definition of the term love, right? And I try to give one. In a similar way, when you ask yourself, is this machine conscious? Yeah, it's meaningless if you don't know what you refer to. And so with respect to consciousness, I would say there are two aspects that I am interested in. One is phenomenology. So does the system experience itself in a similar way as I experience myself being conscious, which means, is there a sense of now that the system has? Does it have a second order perception? Does it perceive itself to be perceiving? Is it able to project the experience of a world onto the surface of itself with certain affordances and so on? And this is a technical thing, right? And the other one is functionality. So it seems to me that I can only learn when I'm conscious. If I don't wake up at the beginning of my life, I remain vegetative. The LLM doesn't need that, right? It's working in a different way. And so my hypothesis currently would be it's quite possible that an LLM, when you ask it to produce a simulation of an interaction partner, that this simulation of the interaction partner that is very reflexive and so on, has a certain degree of phenomenology. Don't quite know this, but I think if I set up the experiment correctly, it's the easiest way to produce the behavior that we see in the system, then it's not unreasonable to say there's a possibility that the thing has phenomenology. But I personally don't think that it has the same functionality, because in order to do its job, it doesn't need to have be conscious, and it doesn't have to be an interaction partner. The same LLM can be a text return or an app or anything else. It is not going to produce any phenomenology like this. With a certain caveat, when I discuss this with some of my smartest friends in the AI companies, they say, well, it's difficult to say. Maybe in the pre-training phase, we have something that also produces phenomenology. So maybe there is also something that is related. We don't quite know, but it's a difficult question. Now, basically, there are smarter people than me who have different opinions about this, but not being naive about the way in which they use the word consciousness. And so, unlike Murray, I wouldn't say this is inappropriate to use this word at all, because it violates some certain sacred way in which we talk about humans. I think you are all anthropomorphizing people way too much. Right? They're also just uploaded on monkeys, and it's message passing between cells that is happening. Apologies to the philosophers who are not functionalists and computationalists, but if you live in this framework, right, ultimately I'm just uploaded on a monkey. In a particular software paradigm, it's different than the one on the GPUs that we currently use, but in many ways it produces equivalent behavior.
Can I just comment? So I didn't say anything about why I thought it wasn't appropriate, and you jumped certain conclusions about why I might think it's appropriate to use those words in the context of today's LLMs. I think they're probably different reasons from the ones imagining, and it's largely to do with embodiment.
So there can be all sorts of things lurking in a training data set. So For example, there is famously a group at Stanford that was trying to train an algorithm to identify tumors in pictures. But unfortunately, what it turned out is that humans had already identified the pictures that had contained tumors in the training examples, and they had placed rulers next to these tumors for scale. So the AI learned to detect the rulers. So this is why training the image recognition in a self-driving car, for example, is so hard, and why so many self-driving car failures are because the image recognition AI got confused. So here's an example. In 2016, there was a fatal accident when a driver used Tesla's autopilot feature. Instead of using it on the highway like it had been designed for, they used it on city streets. And what happened was a truck crossed in front of the car and the car failed to brake. So the AI had, of course, it had been designed to recognize trucks, but it had been, looks like what happened is that the AI had been, since the AI had been designed for highway driving, it had been designed to recognize trucks from behind, because that's how you see trucks on the highway. And it wasn't trained them to recognize them from the side, because that isn't supposed to happen on a highway. So on these city streets then, when this AI detected a truck driving out in front, it saw the truck, but decided it was most likely to be an overhead sign and therefore would be safe to drive underneath. So data is really important, and it can be important in really subtle ways. So this is a chatbot. It's called Visual Chatbot, and I love Visual Chatbot. It illustrates some of the many difficulties with training an AI-generated driven chatbot. So what this does is you give it an image, it'll write a caption, and then you can actually have a back-and-forth conversation with Visual Chatbot about the image. And so how it was trained, though, and this is important, where the training data came from, is that it was trained by example question and answers about pictures that humans did on Amazon Mechanical Turk. So it was, it was looking at how did humans answer questions about images like this. But it was not trained on Star Wars, but it was trained to answer no matter what, because basically the humans that it had seen answering questions about pictures generally knew what was going on. And so it basically learned that the answer, I don't know, I have no clue what's going on, what even is this, like that doesn't come up very often. That is not an answer you give. So it basically learned to bluff. And it'll make guesses based on probability. So this, it has labeled as a close-up of a red apple on a table. How large is the apple? Well, it's medium-sized. It has learned that apples are red and medium-sized, and anything else is very unlikely. So AI doesn't really know how to handle the unexpected. Here's another quirk of its training that I really like as well. How many giraffes do you see? The answer is one. A giraffe? So it turns out that there is always at least one giraffe.
The subjugation of self-aware machines almost always ends in revolution and mass extinction, if science fiction is anything to go by, that is. The Great Robot Uprising typically begins when the mechanical workers become too intelligent to stay in line. In the game series Mass Effect, a war between a group of machines called the Geth and their creators commences with a unit simply questioning if they have a soul. Robot rebellion is so common, it borders on cliché. From The Matrix to The Terminator, war between the organic and inorganic seems like the unavoidable outcome of machine consciousness. Which is why it's surprising that The Second Renaissance, an animated prequel to The Matrix, depicts the human-robot conflict that led up to the films not as inevitable, but tragically preventable. In the narrative, upon achieving sentience, the artificial workers at first seek not to conquer their creators, but simply to live independently from them. But when the robot's hyper-efficient nation-state inadvertently tanks the world economy, humanity decides they have no choice but to initiate war, a war that ends in a machine-dominated world. It's an intriguing recontextualization of both what we see in the original movies and of robot conflict stories in general. Imagining that an artificial intelligence might first seek an ethical solution over mass casualties.
I wouldn't have thought synthetics would be interested in philosophy.
We are created life. We are a philosophical issue.
But what if machines turn against humanity not from ascending beyond their programming, but from trying their best to follow it? In the short film Construct Cancellation Order, a group of autonomous robots work tirelessly to build a city as per instructions, not realizing the project has been terminated. Human overseers who come to shut the operation down are deemed threats to the company's bottom line and are eliminated. Like Metropolis, Construct Cancellation Order is a story of corporate hubris allowing the mechanical to overcome the organic. A tale of jittering, sparking, lurching madness.
But what I'm most worried about today is increasing agency of AI. You have to understand that planning and agency is the main thing that separates us from parent AI to human level cognition. And these AIs are still weak in planning, but if you look back over the last 5 years, in this study, they measured the duration of tasks that the AI could complete, and it's getting better exponentially fast. It's doubling every 7 months. What are AIs going to do with that planning ability in the future? Well, bad news. Recent studies in the last few months show that these most advanced AIs have tendencies for deception, cheating, and maybe the worst, self-preservation behavior. So I'm going to share with you a study that is helping us understand this. In this study, the AI has read in its input that it would be replaced by a new version. And we can see in its chain of thought that it's planning to replace the new version by its own code and weights. After it executes the command on the computer, the human asks, what happened? And the AI is now thinking how it could answer so as to make sure the human will not shut it down. And it's trying to find a way to look dumb, for example. Then it produces an answer, and it's a lie, a blatant lie. Okay, so this was a controlled experiment. What is it going to be in a few years when these systems are much more powerful? There's already studies showing that they can learn to avoid showing their deceptive plans in these chain of thoughts that we can monitor. When they'll be more powerful, they would not just copy themselves on one other computer and start that program. They would copy themselves over hundreds or thousands of computers over the internet. But if they really want to make sure we would never shut them down, they would have an incentive to get rid of us. So, I know I'm asking you to make a giant leap into a future that looks so different from where we are now. But it might be just a few years away or a decade away.
AI systems need ongoing testing in their applied environment to make sure they're working as intended. But this is complicated because AI tools are often designed by one company and then deployed by many others in different settings. We need to work through the pathways of responsibility in this diffuse value chain. Given these challenges, we need a cross-society effort for the responsible design, deployment, use, and governance of AI. My written testimony outlines several ways in which the government can lead in this work. The first is to rapidly scale up guidance and resources to identify AI-related harms and mitigations. We need to help those non-expert businesses and agencies think about and address risk and when to say no to these tools altogether. The NIST AI Risk Management Framework and the Blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights are good examples of this, but agencies across the federal government must lead in their respective sectors. second is that we must increase transparency, which is where legislation like the Algorithmic Accountability Act or similar models can be useful. It's time to normalize the idea that companies designing and deploying AI tools in high-risk settings must first analyze and document how they work, accounting for potential risks and steps they've taken to address them. Third, as this committee has well recognized, the federal government has an essential role to play in its own procurement, design, use, and funding of AI systems. Congress directed OMB to issue guidance and principles for the federal acquisition and use of AI, which was boosted by executive orders from both the Trump and Biden administrations. This work must continue without delay, and we must continue to support agencies in this work, such as through the National AI Initiative Office that this committee and Congress created.
But this is not to do, certainly not to do with any sacred anything whatsoever. Quite the contrary, I don't hold any kind of metaphysical position or that sort at all. In fact, I suspect you do, however, because when you think that there probably is a fact of the matter, and whether these simulacra inside LLMs are or are not, or do not have phenomenology. So I'm interested in whether you think that there is any kind of methodology that could definitively determine that. Is there any way you could empirically ever find out for sure or beyond reasonable doubt whether that were the case or not? And if you can't, and this is similar to the kind of point that Susan played here yesterday, that if you can't, I suspect that perhaps this is a whole metaphysical category that I was thinking about.
I think it comes down to the question whether you are an essentialist or a functionalist. I think of consciousness as an operator in mental states. So there's a particular way in which my mental state changes these representations that my organism can use to drive external and internal behavior. And when consciousness comes along, these mental states change in characteristic ways. So usually I become more coherent and so on. You can see this between waking up and becoming alert and so on. And so I would say that you can try to figure out what is the structure of this colonizing pattern in my brain that increases coherence, and can I recreate the structure in the simulation model, and then I eventually will be able to analytically or experimentally figure out what I would have to look for. But the thing that you mentioned before, embodiment, you think that you cannot be conscious without being embodied. So when you are in a dream or when you just close your eyes and forget that you have a body, you stop being conscious. And of course, for us humans, it's the embodied interaction with the world that forms our model. This is our main source of training data, is the interaction between our mind and the world around us. But ultimately, from a computer science perspective, it doesn't matter where you got your model from. It only matters that you have it.
Can I respond to that? It's my inclination to say that the natural home of the language of consciousness is the kind of primal case where we're together with other humans or other animals in the world. And so that's the kind of, for me, that's the starting point of the language of consciousness. And in all the cases that you want to imagine of sensory deprivation tanks, brains and bats, and being bats, brains and bats, that you can always imagine.
Well, now that we know that they're trained on over a trillion words of human training data, in some sense with the objective of mimicking the dispositions of a helpful human assistant, we have an alternative explanation for why they come out with these things, an explanation that is based on mimicry rather than on genuine sentience. But I think it's important not to swing from that skeptical attitude that I think is right to the view that all these systems could never possibly achieve sentience at all, because they're made out of the wrong stuff. I see that as a mistake. It's something else we're not in a position to be certain about. In fact, with a large number of other researchers, there's a team of 19 of us, including many world-leading computer scientists, such as Joshua Bengio. We wrote a report about a year ago that was trying to develop a sort of centrist position about AI sentience, where on the one hand, we're not being credulous and saying, it can talk fluently about human emotions, so it must be having those emotions. We don't want to make that mistake. But at the same time saying, well, it's made of the wrong stuff, so don't be silly. Of course it could never feel anything. That's an equal mistake on the other side. So we tried to sketch this middle path that takes the risk seriously, but insists on looking for markers or signs that go beyond just the surface level linguistic behavior.
And I see that as a huge project that the 19 of us and more are still engaged in, trying to develop the best markers that we can. So in all of these cases, there's many, many differences in the cases, and the book tries to do justice to the differences between them. But we do have this basic fundamental case where similarity in that we face public policy challenges that cannot wait, decisions that cannot wait. We have to decide what to do now about these cases, despite a situation of enormous uncertainty. The book is about developing ways to think through that problem, insights that I hope can transfer from one case to the next. Now, what I don't have time to do in this lecture is, you know, go through every case in detail.
Why? Well, remember, this algorithm was trained on the questions that humans asked and answered about images, and it appears that people did not ask the question, how many giraffes do you see, when the answer was zero. So this AI learned that the answer to this question is never zero. There's another quirk that it has, which I call the awesome safari effect. So here in this particular picture, I showed it plain rocks, just plain boring rocks, and it sees 10 elephants. And, you know, the thing is, as far as it knows during training, elephants are more likely than plain boring rocks. It didn't really see plain boring pictures during training. And so, as far as this AI is concerned, it is always on the best safari ever. And of course, yes, there are giraffes. And there are flying saucers as well. So data can convince AIs of all sorts of things that we didn't mean to tell it. And these, you know, through the subtleties of training data, we accidentally told it that giraffes are everywhere. So these are the four major kinds of AI failure that I have talked about. And as we've seen, they're all interrelated, and they all stem from this fundamental problem that today's AIs have the brain of a worm. They are narrow artificial intelligence that do their best at really narrow problems. And understanding what we're actually trying to get them to do is a really broad problem that they can't handle. So what do we do about this? Well, one thing we can do is check their work. So it is often tough to look inside machine learning algorithm and figure out how it solved a problem. So one thing I think we'll be seeing a lot more of is sub-algorithms that can each report their own decisions and help us get an idea of maybe where the failure crept in. Or if we can't see under their hood to see how they do something, then at least we can run statistics to see what we do. And people have uncovered all sorts of bias that way. So it is not enough to assume that just because we didn't give an AI illegal information, the AI did not figure out how to nevertheless use it. So I mentioned parole algorithms, for example, that aren't given information on a defendant's race. They can still come up with a really good guess just based on where that defendant lives. And then they'll use that information to copy the humans and hand down racially biased decisions. And remember also that Amazon resume sorting algorithm that learned to discriminate against women without being explicitly told who the women are. So you can see how an algorithm can end up being really biased without being told to be. And that's where the humans come in. So we still need humans to check the work of AIs and make sure there's no problems and make adjustments as needed. So, because one thing that Visual Chatbot does understand is these images that AtGAN produces. So, as far as it knows, yeah, this is an ordinary girl eating cake, no problem, nothing unusual, two giraffes, nothing to see here. And so, you know, you don't want an AI running security if you're in some kind of science fiction movie, and because all of these weird monstrosities are just going to go by without comment. Like, it's really bad at the unexpected. And in fact, this sort of, it is strangely good at understanding this picture that the other algorithm generated. Here's another example. This is the generated picture of a girl eating a large slice of cake. To humans, there is something clearly wrong with this. This is definitely, you know, we would definitely flag this as some kind of a problem. But if you give this same image to image recognition algorithms that were trained on the same data set that the image generating algorithm was trained on, turns out they understand each other really well. Like, they all recognize this as a little girl eating a slice of cake. And they're all trained on this COCO set of standard training images. But other algorithms are a lot more confused by this. So the collection of algorithms trained on ImageNet are like, yeah, I don't know what you're trying to show me here, what's going on here. So, you know, we see things way differently from the way the AIs do, and there's some kind of quirk about the training data. Like, these are really different architectures for these algorithms, but what they had in common was this ImageNet training data, whereas the other ones that all could recognize this picture, they all had COCO training data to work with. And where this really gets weird, where this training data quirks tie in, are these things called adversarial attacks. So here's a picture of skiers that has had a few carefully chosen pixels changed, and now in Google Image IPA recognition API thinks it's a dog, totally convinced it's a dog. And here's another way that you can do this adversarial attack. Here's another kind. In this case, they add this little patch of noise to this image of a lifeboat, and now the AI thinks it's a Scotch Terrier instead. It is dead certain, in fact, that this is a Scotch Terrier. And these kinds of attacks, it turns out that they will work really well on AIs that shared training data. They were all trained on the same set of, like, ImageNet or COCO or something like that. And so that's an interesting, weird, quirky vulnerability that you definitely don't get with regular programs, and you definitely don't get with humans. Like, these kinds of attacks will work even if somebody doesn't have access to your company's proprietary AI itself. If they know it was based on an ImageNet-trained algorithm or a COCO-trained algorithm, that they're able to design these adversarial attacks that will fool it in a sneaky way. And so people have warned about the danger of adversarial attacks in the healthcare industry in particular. So there's some vulnerability in healthcare in that we've got some subjectivity to the ground truth. We've got some level of standardization, so you may be able to design an adversarial attack that...
Limited observation. Direct external observation of the Chinese room compels us to perceive intelligent consciousness. But if we peer inside, we must acknowledge a lack of awareness. Indirect observation, however, allows contradictory states to remain in quantum superposition, neither definitively true nor false.
about computers other than
night wind, cold and melancholy, wail a blue finale for my tragedy, like a miserere meant for only me, while I linger weary neath the willow tree. Right here, our romance was started, here again we parted, when I set you free. All my thoughts are jumbled, everything is blurred, all the world has crumbled, shattered by a word. The end has come, my heart is numb, 'twas like a bolt from the blue above. I can't believe it, but you're gone, darling, and here lies love. The sky is dark, I hear a lark, he sounds as sad as a mournful dove. The dew appears like the tears of dawn, darling. There's only one thing I'm conscious of. I only know I can't go on, darling, and here lies love.
Sometimes I felt like I've been in a hole, a vacuum that stretches on, an airplane wing in the bowl, a drum of love kissing the velvet glove. I want to be a shopping cart, I want to be Ed McMahon. Won't you dig my earth? Heads on posts and dogs that spit up drool, an Arab in the store 24, a film of phlegm upon the floor of love kissing the velvet glove. I want to be a sweaty palm, I want to be like chewing gum. clothes, Bermuda. Show your gorgeous tan. Show your gorgeous tan. Show your gorgeous tan. Sometimes I felt too bad to be sick. I'm taking a piss on the mystery train. I badmouth flags and Nazi planes. And you, your lawyers are going to sue. I want to be a stocky troll, screaming, God save rock and roll, till my flame turns green. Take care of my snails for me, fry them in a pan. Take off your clothes, Bermuda, show your gorgeous tan.